Welcome to The Forum on 90.5 WCBE. Every week, we bring you the conversations that are shaping Columbus, straight from the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Wednesday networking luncheons downtown. The Forum is where leaders, thinkers, and community voices like yours come together to unpack the issues that matter most to Central Ohio. Want to be part of the conversation? We do this every week. You can join us in person. Tickets and details about upcoming forums are available at columbusmetroclub.org. This week, women's health is facing new urgency in Ohio, from maternal mortality and provider shortages to oncology care and postpartum mental health. Today's panelists examine what's working and what needs to change in women's health care. Our forum speakers this week are Jatu Boykai, founder and CEO of the Central Ohio Postpartum Extended Respite Center, Dr. Camila Dixon, director of the General Division of Obstetrics and Gynecology at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, Dr. Shilpa Padilla, co-medical director of oncology at Mount Carmel Health System, and Dr. Mona Prasad, system chief of maternal-fetal medicine at Ohio Health Physicians Group. Your host is Tracy Townsend, news anchor and medical correspondent with WBNS 10 TV. Let's dive into this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, what we get right and wrong about women's health.
Good afternoon. I know you all heard that medical correspondent. You know I'm chomping at the bit for these questions. I love the title, so let's sit back and start thinking of great questions. This is a fantastic panel. I want to just jump right into it because the title, What We Get Right and Wrong About Women's Health, we're not going to go in a row. It's a casual conversation. Let's pretend we've got charcuterie and we have some adult beverages, water if that's your thing, no judgment. But let's just talk about this. If you had to name one thing most people get wrong about women's health, what would it be and why does it matter?
Can I go first?
Absolutely.
I live in a bubble, so I'm a breast surgeon by trade. And I think for me, the fear of pain with a mammogram. And I think that's really important. So mammograms are uncomfortable. I'm not going to sugarcoat it, but they are not painful. But I can't tell you how many people that I see that haven't had a mammogram in years because they were afraid of the pain it was going to cause. Oh. But the earlier breast cancer is caught, the less treatment that you need, the less impact it has on your overall survival, meaning it's not going to impact you long term. So a mammogram is really helpful because the other terrible part is that breast cancer is actually really common, right? And so it doesn't mean you're going to get it, but Americans have the highest rate than anywhere else in the world. So I think that we need to pay attention. Screening mammograms are important, and we shouldn't let pain be a reason and a fear of pain be a reason that you don't get it.
Okay, good start. What else are we getting wrong?
I love that, by the way. I feel like every day I'm telling patients, please get your mammograms. They're not as painful as people say on Reddit or wherever you read it. I think my biggest thing that I think we get wrong is that we think that women's health starts and ends in pregnancy. And I know I'm biased. I deliver babies. I love it. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
But it's true, right? I mean, I think we need care before, we need care during and after for a long time. And I think just reminding my patients sometimes in the office, it's like, well, I haven't seen you in 10 years. Well, I had my babies 10 years ago. There's no reason to see you. No, there are many, many reasons. So I think as a society, focusing more on that is super important.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cammie stole my line. She must have been up with me at 2 a.m. That's literally exactly what I was thinking. But I will echo her words. I think that health in general is a continuum, and we have to remember that women's health starts from the moment we become women until the moment we take our last breath. And so just to echo what she says, women's health does not only entail a pregnancy. It's our entire life.
And I think it matters because if women suffer morbidity and mortality because we have eliminated them or our lens from evaluating and taking care of them throughout the lifespan, women hold our culture together. They hold families together. They hold communities together. They hold the fabric. And so a loss of one person, one female, one woman, mom, it's a ripple that creates generations of issues. And so we need to start prioritizing that, acknowledging the impact that they make, not just in their self, but on our communities and sustainability.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So we will get to what's right. I promise you, we'll get to that. But I want to make sure we define women's health. What are we really talking about? You all kind of touched on that, you know, reproduction, hormones, mental health, something bigger, less. That's really big, but I want to make sure we know what we're working with.
I think the addition to the things that you shouted out were is just the definition of wellness in general. I think as I'll just say for myself, as I'm aging out of reproductive age, that definition of wellness is something that people are kind of grasping for, and it's not necessarily just what's your lipid profile, what's your mammogram, what's your stress test. How are you sleeping? What's your nutrition looking like? What's your libido? How do you feel about your relationships? And I think we have to get really broad in that definition and not limit ourselves, although I appreciate the broadening conversation that we're having.
I see a lot of nodding in agreement. Okay. Anybody want to add to that?
I would just say, I think one of the things I see a lot as women, whether you're a mom or not, we have maternal instinct. And maternal instinct tends to put everyone else before ourselves. And so I think that one of the lessons that I've learned in my practice is that as women, no matter what stage we are, no matter what decade of life we're living, we have to remember to put ourselves first. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean you're forgetting about everyone else, but I always use like the age-old airplane story. You have to put your own oxygen on before you can help someone else. Mm-hmm. And I think that I wish more women understood that you can't continue to be the caregiver and lover and everybody that you are if you aren't taking some sort of personal care of yourself.
Get tired of being tired.
Yeah.
Yeah. So can we talk about the difference in men's and women's health? High level, but I sort of feel, or maybe somebody I know, sort of feel like, you know, once you have your baby, people are like, okay, girl, toodles, we'll catch you around. I mean, how does that vary for men and women?
I live in a female bubble, so I can't really comment.
Well, I think one of the things to call out is that a lot of the healthcare that's evidence-based that's applied to female populations mm-hmm. is rooted in male-based evidence. And so I think we are throwing the kitchen sink of what's worked and the best evidence that we have, but it's not unique or patient-centered for our population. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a big difference is that we know it works for men, or at least proven, and mm-hmm. we're hoping it works for women, and that's the challenge that we have to mm-hmm. face. Mm-hmm.
So sort of to clarify, since we are in Heart Health Month, the symptoms for heart attack in yeah. women and men and how they can be different.
Yeah, I think I was actually looking at that because I have a friend who was speaking at the American Heart Association recently, and really it's just being specific about your complaints and not speaking to minimize. I think women are taught, socialized to soften themselves, not be a problem, not be a burden, but helping women be coached in articulating exactly what they're feeling. How is it impacting your function? How is it impacting your activity of daily living? And really describing it, not being allowed to minimize it when you have them in that healthcare setting. Like, we've got you here. Let's get all we can out of this impactful moment.
And so that leads me to the question about what's right in women's health. Is it too much to have you each tell me three things? I like being in charge of doctors, if y'all can't tell.
I came up with two.
Okay, two. Let's start with two.
But I'm going to get my sheet out because I wrote it down.
Oh, good. You get the gold star.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I didn't miss something. Mm-hmm. I feel like we were talking about this. I have a lot to say. I should probably learn to rein it in a little. So first thing I would say was almost like today is talking about it. I, again, live in a world of breast, so talking about breasts is really taboo. And a lot of reasons why breast cancer was diagnosed so late was because women felt uncomfortable talking about it. And the fact that people like Angelina Jolie, who've never had cancer but underwent bilateral mastectomies and is out in the public talking about it is amazing. I mean, her first Time magazine article in 2014 was so eye-opening. And my favorite part about it was the last thing that she said was, this was my decision, that's not always meant to be yours. And I think that's really important that she made that, because people do follow celebrities and think that they get the best care, but what was right for her may not be right for everyone. And the fact that she knew that and said that was really important. So I think talking about it is definitely the best thing that we do. We're not afraid to talk about breasts. We're not afraid to talk about pelvic regions and things, you know, where that absolutely was not something we could talk about.
Sure.
The second thing that I wrote down was there is a volunteer organization, it's called Ohio Partners for Cancer Control, and I used to be part of it. It is individuals from every health system in Ohio that come together that volunteer their time to improve cancer care, all cancer care, throughout Ohio. And it is one of the best forums I've ever been in to hear people speak. And no one cares that you're from what institution you're from and that you may be competing, quote unquote, right? That we're in different institutions in Columbus. But at the end of the day, we all train to take care of patients. We work where we work, but that isn't what our passion is behind. And so to hear those people come together to create a cancer plan for all of Ohio is amazing. So I think we are doing some things right. I still think we do many things wrong, but we are moving in a direction where things are being done and people are talking about it.
Okay. Who wants to build on that?
I'll go.
Okay, sure.
So I think I will build on the first thing that you said. I think talking about it is key. Every conversation that we have about women's health we can't talk about it enough. And so I definitely agree that talking about it is one of the things that we are getting right. Specifically in Central Ohio, we do a really good job of continuing the conversation. This is my second appearance, and I'll be happy to come back and talk about it again. So talking about it, Doug's like, I'll email you, Doug. but secondly, I think another thing that specifically, again, Central Ohio does really well is that we come together as a community. And not only do we talk about the specific problems that our community is facing, but we come together and we sort of pool our resources. And then we go out and do what we can to help. I think we do a really good job of that. We have a lot of community organizations that do similar work, but we also, you know, while a lot of organizations replicate services, we also, you know, have like an organization that, just for example, my organization, we do doula services free of charge, but we may not necessarily have a lactation consultant, so we know an organization that does, so we'll cross-refer, things like that. When we come together as an organization, our moms and our babies are covered, and that is exactly what I think we do a really good job of here in Columbus.
Right. I think I want to echo that for sure. I think we were chatting before we got up here, and even just like looking out in the audience, it's really telling to me that there's so many of us that are connected to other people, right? And we are in different health systems, and I think it's been really one of the things that I've loved working here in Central Ohio is that there just is collaboration. It's not the like, oh, I'm at OSU, I can't give trade secrets to this, that, or the other, or oh, I want to keep all the patients for myself. I think we recognize there are more than enough patients and there's a huge need, and the only way we're going to actually like move the needle on this work is working together. And we see that in community spaces as well. I'm the medical director of Moms to Be, and we work wholly in working with other organizations. And I think the only way to support families is to be able to do that. And then kind of jumping back to the conversation as far as like talking about it, I think we are doing a better job of talking about issues. I was joking with someone else this week even. I mean, like, I've been doing this for a minute now, and it's really interesting that only in the last few years people are really talking about menopause and perimenopause. That's not new. I mean, this is not like people now finally are going through menopause. No, this has been happening forever. But like now we're actually allowed to talk about it, which means that the patients have a voice, and I think that is huge. I'm having patients come to me and saying, okay, these are my symptoms, what are we doing about it? And don't tell me, oh, it's normal and we're walking out the door, right? So I think that piece is super important that we're really starting to listen.
That's great.
I have a couple things, one that's in my lane, one that's out. So I'll start out of my lane, which is one of the best things that's happening in women's health that I don't think gets enough press is the Gardasil vaccine or HPV vaccination. We live in an era of vaccine hesitancy. I have public health training. I would take a vaccine any dime, any day. But cervical cancer is related to HPV. And by vaccinating kids or anybody up to the age of, is it like 45, I think, we are seeing a big dent in the incidence of cervical cancer, and it just deserves a call out because it's one of the few, like, we did this and it's working that we get in women's health. And so I wanted to make sure we said that. The other thing that's happening that I think is great, though we have lots more work to do, is the pregnancy-associated mortality review. That is actually federally funded, but every state has a pregnancy-associated mortality review where we're looking at the reasons why we're losing moms in this developed, highly resourced, even though not equally resourced, but compared to other countries, highly resourced community, and we're still losing moms. And what we've learned from that is and is the second leading cause of maternal mortality is actually related to mental health issues. And I can say in our institution, we're taking a really active role in investigating that and trying to develop care that meets women and acknowledges that on the front end, rather than hoping we, again, that strategy of hope is not a great one, and so rather than hoping we can avoid it, but like finding out where are we starting, how does pregnancy and your initial touches with the healthcare system impact that, and how can we mitigate it so you can have a successful lifelong journey?
So I do want to get to maternal health. I'm still stuck on 88 counties, 13 do not have obstetric care. So can we talk about maternal health? And we know that Franklin County mothers, particularly minority women, have higher rates of infant mortality. Let's talk about how that's being addressed. And really, why are Black women still facing significantly higher maternal mortality rates? Excuse me.
I'll go first. So this may lead off into a different conversation, but I think that this nation as a whole struggles with telling the truth about our history, the depth and the breadth of our history, and I think that that affects our future, and it affects the potential for the solutions that we can put forth for, you know, the solutions that we have for our future. You know, I can walk outside right now and encounter somebody, you know, within 10 feet of me that's uncomfortable talking about slavery. That's unacceptable. And so if that's the case in 2026, how can we then, you know, truly come up with solutions for a system that was built on racism? And I'm not trying to be a Debbie Downer. So sorry to bring it there. But, you know, when we think about, you know, I've been a nurse for 15 years, and I was part of a healthcare system, very proud labor and delivery nurse. And, you know, I learned about the concept of moral injury very quickly into my career, and it's something that I started to experience being a Black nurse in healthcare, especially in labor and delivery, because I realized that I was part of a system that was not built, it was not designed, it was not created to protect, to care for, to save people who look like me. And so you have to ask yourself the question, and you have to be honest when you answer the question. If that system was not built to protect you, is it broken or is it functioning exactly as intended? That's a hard pill to swallow. And where do you go from there when you honestly answer that question?
Where do you go?
Doug said I can ask other questions, so I'm going to ask a question. I don't know where to go from there. I will answer my own question. I think it starts with doing the work, being honest, and going out into the community and putting your eyes on the problem and actually like just doing the best that you can to. I'll give an example. You talked about, or Dr. Prasad actually talked about maternal mental health. When I started my nonprofit, within the first year, we lost a mom and a baby to mental health. She took her own life and her baby's life. And it was like, hit us like a ton of bricks. But obviously we couldn't stop. We had to do something, and it lit a fire under us to like really figure out what's happening here. And it refocused me to start looking at postpartum as, you know, as a focus point. And I started doing research. And what I realized is that 65% of what we consider pregnancy-related deaths happen after that 6-week mark. After, you know, the doctor's like, see ya, you're good. And a lot of these women don't have a PCP. They don't have, you know, any mental health services that they can seek out. And we're leaving them high and dry. And I'm glad that you brought up the pregnancy associated and maternal, you know, mortality review board, because what happens is, you know, a woman goes to the ER and she dies of an aneurysm, she dies of a heart attack, she dies of a liver, you know, laceration, whatever she dies of. And then we find out that she has an 8-month-old at home, and then it goes to the review board. And that's how we associate it with a pregnancy. And it's almost this very insidious, quiet way that we're adding these deaths to the death toll. Nobody even knows about it. It's not getting the national attention that, you know, it would get if she died right there in childbirth. And so I think, you know, we just have to put more focus on that time frame, because it's so important. We need to connect moms with a PCP after that 6-week mark. We can't just say, peace out, you're good to go. We can't do that, which is hard, because, you know, we're when you're in childbearing age, you think you're healthy, you don't really need a doctor. Yes, you do. You need to follow up. You know, sometimes people don't even realize they're going through postpartum depression until they're a year in. I have a 3-year-old, and I'm like, there are days. There are days. So there's a lot to it. It's a heavy lift, and there's no one answer. But, you know, we have to start by understanding that we're all individuals that are part of a system that is so much bigger than us, and we have to start by being honest about that. And if we can't do that, then we're in trouble.
I echo what you said. I think that piece is super important. I mean, even thinking about the systems in place. And as you were talking, I started thinking about even just the idea of safety, right, and trust, which is something, two components that are super important for me in the care of my patients and the running of my division and all that. But, you know, I kind of reflect on some of the patients that I see day to day, knowing that in Columbus, I'm one of maybe 13, 14 black OBGYNs. There are not many of us, right? So many, many, many of my patients seek me out, wait a year or two to see me, because they want to see someone who looks like them, who can understand, you know, potentially the fear of, if I were to get pregnant again, would I survive this pregnancy, right? Very heavy question, very heavy something to think about in a time that, for most people, comes with a lot of joy and excitement and normal anxiety, because pregnancy is an anxious time, right? So I think it's important to make sure that we do continue to have this conversation, which I know is the most trite answer of any kind of panel you can ever be on. Thanks for having this conversation. We don't keep on having this conversation, but I think that is super important. And I think it's important for everyone to kind of reflect on this, because like I said, there are, if you think of, the work can't just be on the 13 or 14 black OBGYNs in the city, right? It's on everybody in every space. And then I think that's also where expanding our connections and care is super important. That's why I am a huge proponent of doula care. I think it's super important for people when they're coming for during birth and after to have support people that they feel trusting in the room, right? And of course, the ultimate goal I would have is that every health system I ever work in, every single doctor, nurse, PCA, everybody who's ever touched and involved a patient would be one that would engender trust in a patient. And I think that's our goal ultimately, but I think to start, we do have to all recognize that we have a piece in this.
Got one more thing?
I'm sorry. Also, you mentioned doula care. I want to also mention midwifery care is so important. And I think that's another thing, and this is bigger than me, bigger than us, as a nation, you know, most, if not all, developed nations that have pivoted or prioritized midwifery care have seen improvements in maternal care, like significant improvements. And I think that going back to, you know, being honest, like we're not doing well. We're not doing well as a nation. And to see other nations doing well and like they figured it out, and we're kind of just sitting here like, well, you know. We're doing okay. We're not. And there's an answer. And sometimes it's almost like, have you ever watched a toddler get dressed And by the end, you're like, there were like four other ways to do that a lot better, but you got it. It's kind of like that. Like, there are ways to do this better, and we know what those ways are, and now it becomes, okay, are we going to do it, or are we just going to sit here and continue to watch other nations do it better?
Do you think we need to rely a little bit or put pressure on the systems that are bigger than us, ACOG, our legislature, our funding streams, to make sure that women's health is funded, to continue to elevate the voices of these single rare moms that have this ripple, but collaborate, or like bring them together, make those voices matter, and make sure their stories are told above us to people who are policymakers, payers, whatever, because I think women's health is overall underfunded, undervalued, as are women just in general. And so I used to get very frustrated because I'm like, I'm in this job now, somebody should listen. And then you realize, like, actually those people only listen to those people. And so aligning with them and pushing those national organizations to continue to protect Medicaid expansion and reimbursement to make sure that we are able to keep our maternity deserts open, because doctors have to be able to live in the maternity desert, you know, and so to be there. And so in order for us to try to touch all those people, it does take a huge system overhaul, and we have to be willing partners with the people that can actually move that chain better than our individual voices.
I was going to ask about realistic solutions for the maternity care desert. That just seems daunting and frightening. And this is 2026.
Yeah, I know. I keep saying we just need a bus, a mobile unit, and telehealth, and all those things. There isn't a great, or I have said we should just put buses in the region and bring people in and take them home. I don't know exactly how we do that in the acute phase. That's sure. Very hard. You hear stories all the time of patients that have driven by three hospitals to get to a maternity care center, and by the time they've gotten there, they're in extremes. And we have to look closely at why those other places are not able to sustain healthcare for 50% of their population.
Okay.
Sorry.
This should be a two-hour, or like 90 minutes. Okay, before I'm not looking at Doug, but give me the high sign if you need me to, if you need me to. I want to talk about why did society seem to treat perimenopause and menopause like a private inconvenience for decades? What changed? Was it Halle Berry or what? What?
Or Oprah.
Or Oprah.
Dr. Mary Claire. I'll say I'm guilty. When I was a resident, the Women's Health Initiative came out and they said HRT is bad for everybody, and we took that and we didn't ask any other questions. And we were like, I remember joking saying it when I came out of residency, I'm like, oh, I'd love to do a menopause practice. That'd be pretty easy. Not much treatment options. We'd be like, hey, nice to see you. Get on with it. But I would never do that. But now we are seeing that there's risk stratifications and things that where the impact of not having HRT less than 60 years old is a big deal. It impacts your cardiovascular health, your mental health, your body composition, et cetera. And I think now women are realizing that their voice matters, thank goodness, and they're expressing that dissatisfaction with the status quo. Mm-hmm. And we're forced to respond, and I think in a place where the evidence wasn't great and we were clinging to it, we are being forced, as we say, to look with curiosity and say, what is in there that we could still learn from, instead of being so dogmatic in the weak evidence that existed.
You're listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. This week, women's health is facing new urgency in Ohio. From maternal mortality and provider shortages to oncology care and postpartum mental health, today's panelists examine what's working and what needs to change in women's health care. This week, we're hearing from Jatu Boykai with the Central Ohio Postpartum Extended Respite Center, Dr. Camila Dixon with The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, Dr. Shilpa Padilla with Mount Carmel Health System, and Dr. Mona Prasad with the Ohio Health Physicians Group. Your host is Tracy Townsend, news anchor and medical correspondent with WBNS 10TV. We'll get back to this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, what we get right and wrong about women's health, after a short break.
Hi there, this is Morgan James. Every album represents a step in an artist's journey. Hello, music lovers. I'm inviting you to listen to Music Journeys with Mike Foley. Mike mixes music and conversation with artists to share what informed and inspired their latest project, how the love of music began, what music means to them, and so much more. We've chatted about three of my projects, the most recent being Soul Remains the Same, a soul album of songs you would never expect. You can always expect the perfect combination of music and stories on Music Journeys. The show airs Saturday afternoons at 3:30 on WCBE. Recent episodes are available on the major podcast platforms and the WCBE app. To meet and hear more from all the musicians featured since its start in 2018, including me, to be the first to be featured three times on the show, look for Music Journeys on WCBE's podcast experience at WCBE.org.
Stay up to date on your favorite WCBE podcasts with the WCBE app, available now to download for free on iOS and Android.
Welcome back to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. Women's health touches families, workplaces, and entire communities. Today's panel examines systemic gaps, promising innovations, and how Central Ohio can lead the way in improving outcomes for women at every stage of life. This week, we welcomed Jatu Boykai, founder and CEO of the Central Ohio Postpartum Extended Respite Center, Dr. Camila Dixon, director of the General Division of Obstetrics and Gynecology at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, Dr. Shilpa Padilla, co-medical director of oncology at Mount Carmel Health System, and Dr. Mona Prasad, system chief of maternal-fetal medicine at Ohio Health Physicians Group. Your host is Tracy Townsend, news anchor and medical correspondent with WBNS 10 TV. Let's get back to this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, what we get right and wrong about women's health.
I mean, I think maybe this is a little controversial, maybe not. I mean, but I think if you think about like societal views, like for so long, the purpose of a woman was to have a child, right? So you fulfill that purpose, you no longer have your period. We don't really care. We don't care. You did your thing. Move to the side. Yes, you're having hot flashes. We don't care. You'll be okay. Here's a towel, right? I mean, for real,
wow.
That's what it was. It was. And I think, thankfully, people push back. And thankfully, people are like, no. And I think it, unfortunately, does take sometimes celebrities to be like, hey, hot flashes are real. Brain fog is real. Like, you know, these mood changes are not cute. I'm trying to do my work and do my job. And this is getting in the way. And I think, finally, we're at a place where we can actually start to really talk about mm-hmm. it. But I think it's because people... I hope, and maybe I'm just being Pollyanna, but I think people are taking women more seriously now. I do. We're more than a womb. So I think that this, now we can actually hear what's going on with them.
That's a good campaign slogan, more than a womb. I think that's really good.
I'm really thankful for that because I'm 37 and I don't think that we ever talked about perimenopause. And I feel like knowing that perimenopause can last 10 years is very important for a 37-year-old because it's coming. And I'm scared. And had we not been talking about it, mm-hmm. I probably, you know, seriously though, because like we could be going through symptoms and not really knowing
what's wrong,
what's happening. Mm-hmm. So it's really important that we talk about these things.
I want to get back in your lane. All right, let's talk about the biggest myths women believe about breast and or gynecologic cancers. Whew. That you wish we could correct today.
Ooh, okay.
Okay, next week.
I got this. One is that having a mastectomy means that you have aggressive cancer or advanced stage. Neither is true. Mm-hmm. It is actually a personal choice. It is very rare that I'm the one saying that you need to have that surgery. We all know somebody that's had that procedure performed, and the first thought was, oh, she had to have a mastectomy. Mm-hmm. That is not actually, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Even the smallest of cancers that are completely survivable can do that. If that's, it's a woman's choice. Mm-hmm. And so one of the biggest myths I always talk about is dispelling that thought. The flip side of that though is the other myth is that having a mastectomy means everything's gone and nothing can go wrong. Also not true. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of women that out of fear make that decision to have a mastectomy, both sides mastectomy, because supposedly that's supposed to make you live longer, but that's actually not true. And so it's really, I always tell women that my job is to educate you to make your best informed decision, right? There's no right or wrong answer. It is really a personal mm-hmm. choice. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest piece of all of that, and I think that transcends gynecologic cancer, breast cancer, is that a cancer diagnosis is not always a death sentence anymore. I think whenever we're all afraid of that. I mean, personally, we base our, a lot of the way that we view life is based on our past experiences, right? So I'll use my dad passed away of metastatic liver cancer in 4 months when I was 17, right? So my vision of cancer was that it takes you, and a very healthy man that was walking and eating healthy and was literally gone right before I started college. But that isn't always the case, and actually it's rarely the case. Mm-hmm. If it's caught early, it does, that C word doesn't have to be as scary. And so I think the biggest myth that, like, from my oncologic standpoint, is to say that screening tools are really important. It doesn't mean that you're going to get cancer, but in the event that you are that one, the earlier it is caught, it is not going to be a death sentence. And I think men and women need to understand that mm-hmm. cancer is scary, no doubt about it. But the earlier it's caught, the less treatment you need, meaning you most likely don't need chemo, which is what everyone's biggest fear is. You don't need radical surgeries, and long-term outcome is actually really okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. Can we give them a round of applause real quick? We do really appreciate your candor, your conversational tone. It is CMC's longstanding tradition to take audience questions, and so this is where it gets interactive. Maybe it'll get more interesting. I don't know. I think you all have been really good. We'll move to questions from the live stream and the in-person audience in just a minute. Remember, communication is a two-way street. If you have a question for our panelists, now is the time to head to the microphone, because Doug is waiting for you right there. You're going to be lit. It's going to be beautiful. For those who are joining us on YouTube, just drop your questions in the chat. And before we turn it over to the audience, I have one last question. I love being the questioner. What question should every woman ask her doctor but rarely does? Do, do,
do, do. I wrote this down too. I came up with three.
Oh, okay.
Okay, yeah, so I figured, okay. First one, what lifestyle changes can I make to reduce my cancer risk? I say this because in 2020, a study came out that showed that if you did professional hair dye once every 5 to 8 weeks, which, can I please have a show of hands of how many women get their hair dyed professionally once every 5 to 8 weeks? Thank you. It increases your risk of breast cancer by 18%. And when you're African American and use relaxers, et cetera, and have black hair, that increases your risk by 32%. So boxed hair dye, interestingly, does not count, but my point is that there are lifestyle things that we don't think are related that can actually reduce your cancer risk. So that was one of my first question, which I will thank my nurse in my office. She came up with that one. Number two, which I think we've all harped on, is what screening studies should I do? And again, that goes back to the earlier cancer is caught, the less treatment you need, the less impact it has on your lifespan. And then this is very much in my personal bubble, but what is my family history significant? And do we need any further investigation? I see a lot of women for other things, and I look at their family history and go, I know you're here for this, but we really need to talk about this. And I don't think we put enough emphasis on family history. So those were the three things I came up with.
Dr. Prasad?
I was just thinking about this sitting here, but I think there's gotta be some question about, like, how can we be real with each other? Like, how can you challenge me? How can I question you? How do we get to that point where we have a trust relationship that's bidirectional? And I think specific to kind of my world is how does my pregnancy impact my lifelong risk? And I don't know that we ask that question enough.
Okay. Dr. Dixon?
These are all really great questions.
They
I'll
are good.
Write them
They're
down.
Really good.
I don't even know. I mean, I think... The very basic question that I get from patients often is, what do your other patients normally ask that I haven't, right? So I think that that's actually a good trigger, because I try to craft my, you know, when I go over whatever thing, I'm like, okay, my patients normally say this, 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 and this, this, and this, but sometimes I forget. So I think that's a nice way of being like, you know, to jog the memory of your doctor.
The doc's got it.
Okay. All right. All right, so now we want to hear from you. Doug, you have a question?
Tracy, thank you very much. Thank you so much to today's panelists. If you have a question for today's panelists, please do join me here at the microphone. If you haven't seen your doctor in a while, well, this is a pretty good opportunity right here. If you're watching online, please type your questions into the chat. I'll try to get to as many of those as I can. Great questions at CMC always have two things in common. They can be asked in about 30 seconds or less. And what punctuation mark does a question end with? ends with a question mark. It's always good to remind ourselves of that. And a correction, I just was looking at some articles here. Ohio may have as many as 24 counties without an OBGYN. That's according to an article in the Ohio Capital Journal. So might be even even higher than we were thinking. Mm-hmm. I'll launch us off with this one. Dr. Dixon mentioned, and I think several of you did, Dr. Dixon mentioned doula care. Can you define doula care and how is it different from other types of care?
So a doula is a non-clinical, essentially a birth companion that supports you through your pregnancy, at your birth, and through the postpartum period. They are well versed in all things women's health, all things pregnancy, childcare. A lot of them are also certified in lactation. And so essentially, I kind of coin it as like your perinatal best friend. If your best friend was really, really good at all things maternal health, that's what a doula is. And so it's the person that you want to be there with you throughout the entire pregnancy. Doulas can be very expensive, and so there are community organizations out there that offer up doula services completely free of charge. There is also now Medicaid reimbursement for doulas, and so there are ways to get a doula to support you through your pregnancy here in Ohio.
Just to add to that, I think the important piece is that they are well-versed, right? So sometimes I have patients who are like, my mom's going to be my doula. I'm like, your mom's your birth support person, which is great. But she's not, just because she had you doesn't mean she's well-versed in everything that you need. So really important when you're seeking a doula to look for that.
And a doula is going to advocate for you. That's a big piece to it, especially, you know, for women of color in the birth space. Sometimes advocacy is a very important piece, and a doula is going to help to not necessarily speak for you, but help you find your voice in that space.
Thank you. My name is Colleen, and I'm a nonprofit fundraising consultant, so it's really helpful for me to see what organizations are coming together. I have a personal interest in this topic, so thank you all for the work that you're doing again. My question is about the NIH study that you brought up and the impact that it's sort of the revisions are having. So the question that I have for you is, what do you see that providers can be doing differently in light of that to kind of help re-educate patients? And more broadly, what types of things can providers do to create those environments where people, women can come and ask, you know, really honest questions and feel vulnerable?
The NIH study, you're talking about the women's health. Okay. Sometimes. I'm just making sure that I'm on the same page. I think you have to ask all your questions and don't leave until you're done. I think, again, you're gonna encounter practitioners who were trained in my generation who might need your prodding to say, is my fund of knowledge where it needs to be on this, and do I need to be reading more and looking more, asking more questions? At Ohio Health, I can say we have one provider who is an OBGYN physician, my generation, who is now cross-collaborating with cardiovascular physicians, et cetera, and we're all learning together what are the appropriate risk stratifications for women in that menopause, perimenopausal time. And so I think maybe acknowledging that, hey, this is changing, this is a landscape that's changing, this is what I'm learning, what are you learning, and what for me is the best practice.
And I would add to that so that is kind of the bread and butter of a general OBGYN. We should be able to talk about menopausal care. But to add to that, what's really nice is that the Menopause Society actually has a certification. So at Ohio State, we have two physicians who are menopause certified, and we have two midwives as well, and increasing people who are interested in getting that certification. And there are many other people around the city as well. So that is one way you can go to the website and find the people who are certified if you feel that your particular generalist or, you know, your primary care physician is not addressing the questions that you would like.
Thank you. My name is Joyce Chen. I'm at The Ohio State University. I just had a question about, given that a lot of the tech industry, as well as startup financing, are still male-dominated industries, what are the best ways for women to advocate for having more research on women's health specifically and studies that focus on outcomes for women?
Great question. This isn't a great answer. But I will say that most recent studies that I've seen show that med school graduating classes now tend to be dominated by women. And I think that trend is really helpful, because when you start putting, when that graduating class and those inquisitive minds start happening, they're going to start looking at their own population. Does that make sense? So I don't have a great answer for today, I guess. And I'd be really curious what you all think. But I do know that I have hope for the future based on who is coming out and who is graduating and what they are going to be looking to.
That is the answer. Represententation matters, and we do tend to focus our energy on things that matter to us. So as women start to dominate these fields, the research is going to start to follow.
Hi, my name is Michael Bullock, and I'm the president of Miles's Mission. Hello, Jatu. My daughter Jennifer, who is a news anchor on a different network here in Columbus, in 2021, she lost her son Miles at 33 weeks. And we engaged in this community of pregnancy and infant loss and found out that Ohio's in the top five when it comes to losses. And the conversation, kind of like today, I appreciate the maternal mortality and all the other things of women's health, but it seems as if this conversation about fetal mortality still gets left out of the mix. As you said, even with slavery, people feel uncomfortable about talking about child death. And yet, it's as much of a part of women's health. It's being left out of developing the women after the fact, and the guilt and shame and embarrassment and all the things they go through. And with Jen, because it was public, because she had to do it on air, it really challenged our family. And so part of what we've done, our organization, is all three of your hospitals, Central Ohio Hospital Council, we've developed a bereavement care package with Jeff Klingler. And you guys have signed up with it, Dr. Melillo here. But how do we get this narrative to become even more of a conversation, and how do you make it inclusive when you're talking about women's health because of what needs to be done preventatively up front so that it doesn't happen? Because of the stillbirths in Ohio, almost 900 every year, 47% of those could have been prevented. So what do we do to change that narrative, to include it in the conversation, and how can we do better for women in that situation?
So there's an organization called Count the Kicks that I know you're familiar with that does a really good job of training maternal staff on training moms on fetal monitoring, or their own fetal monitoring, so that they're monitoring their baby's movements to ensure that they are cognizant of their baby's movements to ensure that stillbirths are prevented. And so I think by engaging with organizations like that, that's one of the ways to continue to keep the conversation going. Potentially, not only engaging with organizations like that, but maybe creating more organizations like that would be a better way, because I think Count the Kicks is a very niche organization, and it's one of a kind. And so I think, you know, just like there are several doula organizations out there, and there are several you know, midwifery organizations out there, Count the Kicks is one of a kind. And so I think maybe having them branch out or creating an organization similar to Kick the Counts would be a good way to increase the scope and increase the reach of what they're trying to do, because what they are doing is extremely important. They've had a lot of saves. I've heard of their success. I think where are they based? Is it Oklahoma? Iowa. They've had a lot of really, really tremendous stories, and I think, you know, increasing their reach is really important.
I do think that there are legs to really getting people comfortable with conversations. I know when you have a pregnancy loss, the society doesn't know what to say to you, your friends don't know what to say to you, and everybody gives you that hope of, well, there'll be a next time. And that's just not what people need to hear. And so I think there are kind of some specific trainings that will get people more comfortable just with the conversation itself and give voice to that, so that women can feel seen and heard throughout their course. Trauma-informed care is something that's very, very important. We're not all great at it, and it's a place of opportunity for sure. And then when you talk about preventable loss, that to me says we've missed an opportunity. And how do you sort of then approach everybody and leave your what you think about the situation behind? Like, how do you leave your bias? How do you leave your jump to conclusion? How do you leave the story that somebody told you about the patient in room, whatever, and actually see them for who they are? And I think that's where kind of some safety bundles are working, and we're trying to really control our controllables in a way that hopefully limits bias, limits your preconceived notions or how bad your day was when you walked in that room, and really makes you kind of abide by some standards and that are very well acknowledged, well developed, and hopefully we won't miss those misses because of whatever extraneous forces were there.
Thank you, everyone. We have a 5 minutes left. Let's try to get to at least two more questions.
Okay. My name is Mindy Wright. I'm a member of the program committee. I want to revisit the maternal health care deserts in Ohio for a moment. Ohio's clearly not doing anything about those. Are there places across the country that you're aware of that are addressing those that we might begin to look at as models?
My only experience in that is New Mexico. They have very, very limited health resources throughout that state, particularly for maternity care. And in my specialty, which is maternal fetal medicine, it's kind of niche down care. And they have a really robust network of telehealth, et cetera. It's also, New Mexico's the birthplace of Project Echo, which was kind of rooted in hepatitis C management. And what they basically did was train people in the periphery with screening tests, et cetera, and then they bring the questions of physicians to the experts who are kind of providing consultation and empowering then the region to execute on the care that might feel niched. So it's not exactly an answer to the maternity care, but there's probably lessons learned there that we can learn to leverage in our places, but it's an investment for sure.
Hello, my name is Tisha Reed. I'm the director of the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center's Healthy Community Center, a mouthful. Some of the questions I had were actually somewhat answered, but one on the maternity health deserts is that one thing, as you pointed out, that we need to speak the truth on is that it is around money. So we need to address that. We know that because maternity healthcare really doesn't bring in the dollars that you see, and so that's the first thing that's cut. So how can we address that along with some of the other pieces that you just spoke of, as well as is there some type of training that we are doing or are involved in as you look at how you can work collaboratively to address respectable quality care, and that's something that we're not really talking about. But when you look at reproductive care, you're looking at respectful quality care where there's some shared decision making. There is freedom from the abuse that we think that doesn't happen but is happening, and the communication and where everyone is listening to each other, and actually, as you talked about before, when women can be honest and tell what's going on detail wise, those things are documented. And with that, also, how can you promote some clinical women in clinical trials, knowing that it has a lot of male science-based? Thank you.
Okay, that's a lot of questions, but we're gonna try to briefly get there. I don't wanna interrupt anybody, but we're moving along in our schedule.
This is teed up for Cami Dixon.
Yeah, I was like, yeah. So I would say that kind of addressing the, you talked about the training for more respectful care. One of the projects that I've been actively involved in, and in Ohio, is through our Ohio Perinatal Quality Collaborative. It's called the CARE Project. And the idea behind it is to get multiple hospital systems across Ohio to focus on that respectable care, to help build better outcomes for everybody. Inherent in that, we're now in our third year of doing this, but in the first year, one of the things we found is making sure that we have good data. We have to see what the outcomes are to be able to understand where the discrepancies are. Additionally, we recognize over our time that collaboration with community is super important as far as building safety and building just, yeah, safety for the patients, right? So this, the community is where people feel safe. Hospital systems, unfortunately, historically, is not where people, they're not where people feel safe. So our collaborations are such that we can build that and help to build that trust and be able to learn what are the experiences people are having and how can we approach people in the best way so people can come to the hospital, feel safe, and get the best care. So that's definitely kind of one of the projects we're working on.
Thank you so much. All right, let's give this panel one more round of applause. And I want to thank you for your participation and turn it over to Sophia Fiffner.
You've been listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. This week, we examine the state of women's health in Central Ohio, from maternity, mortality, and provider shortages to oncology care and postpartum mental health. We explored where systems are failing women and where new models of care are offering hope. This week, we welcomed Jatu Boykai with the Central Ohio Postpartum Extended Respite Center, Dr. Camila Dixon with The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, Dr. Shilpa Padilla with Mount Carmel Health System, and Dr. Mona Prasad with the Ohio Health Physicians Group. Your host was Tracy Townsend, news anchor and medical correspondent with WBNS 10 TV. The presenting sponsors of CMC's Optimal Health Series are Nationwide Children's Hospital, Ohio Health, and the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. This forum was also sponsored by Mount Carmel Health System. The presenting sponsor of our live stream was the Center for Human Kindness at the Columbus Foundation. Our live stream partner was the Columbus Dispatch. This forum was also supported by Downtown Columbus Incorporated and the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. If you'd like to keep exploring this week's forum topic, our friends at the Columbus Metropolitan Library recommend reading The New Rules of Women's Health by Megan Rabbit. Join us next week as the not-for-profit Columbus Metropolitan Club once again connects people and ideas through community conversations. I hope you'll join us. I'm Doug Buchanan. Thanks for listening.